Hi, everybody. I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is A Good Story Is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies they love and the traces of the one reality they see below the surface.
Yes, yes. This is episode number 94. And today we're going to talk about Super 8. Last time we talked about a little-known author. And and this time we're going to talk about a little-known director. We just like to try to help these people in their career.
And the producer, I feel like this guy really could be something big if
he might, you know, be. He might be someday.
Got some help.
If he just keeps trying.
Yeah.
The writer and director of this movie is J.J. Abrams. And the producer is Steven Spielberg.
Yeah, and this, in a very real sense, this really looks like J.J. Abrams' tribute to Steven Spielberg's movies, especially the movies featuring kids.
Yeah,
I
think so too. It does have kind of an E.T. feel to it. Except for the alien
angry E.T. who's been tortured by the government for
that's
a few
right.
years.
That damn
that's
government.
That's exactly what it is.
Exactly right.
E.T. gone wrong.
Yeah, and E.T. was chased around by the government too.
This is the story of if he didn't get away. Good one.
Indeed.
Part two.
Yes, part two. I did find a interview with Abrams and Spielberg. And, Spielberg was glowing while Abrams explained what he was doing. But he did say, Abrams said that this was a story of it was inspired by his own childhood, which in turn was inspired by Spielberg's movies because, he spent a lot of time watching them. Yeah. So.
Well, and I really can see that because last weekend I rewatched Poltergeist.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I was watching it with my mother, who we were having a horror film fest.
And I love this. The 2014 Ladies Horror Film Fest. That is so great. Yeah. Anyway, go ahead.
My 80-year-old mother, my 26-year-old oldest daughter, and me gathered together for 3 days to scare ourselves to death. Anyway, but we were watching Poltergeist, which it's funny. Mom was not as crazy about. She said it was like mashing E.T. together with a monster movie, a horror movie. And I could really, after all this time, because I remember seeing it in the theater, but after all this time, I could really see it. And so then watching Super 8, you could really see, oh, yeah, that's what Spielberg did so well. He could just capture these kids' lives and world. And that homebody suburban American feel.
Yeah, yeah. He gave us in E.T., really the family dynamic. And in E.T., I think she was divorced, the Elliot's mom.
Yeah.
And here the mother has passed away at the very beginning of the movie. You see that she's not there.
Yeah.
And so that's an interesting thing, too. I don't know if it was on purpose or anything. But, kids movies, movies that focus on the kids often have, the missing adult, somehow in it to give them, independence. I don't know what, I think that's the purpose of it or yeah. What are your thoughts?
I don't know. I know Disney's done it consistently for a really long time.
Yeah. And YA books often.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, a whole lot.
I know. I was trying to think of some that have both the parents where it focuses on the kids. And I know there are. My brain is freezing up.
Yeah.
But in this case, they do focus a touch on the father's problem.
Sure. Sure they do.
Not a lot.
Yeah, some. Some. In fact, I think that was part of what Abrams was interested in was the character of the dad as well. But seen from the kid's point of view. So let's do a quick synopsis first.
Yes.
Yeah, so the movie takes place in 1979, even though the movie was made in 2011. It's about a group of friends who spend a lot of time making movies. And one night they are out making a movie. They've snuck out. It's really late. And they're making a movie and they witness a train crash. And after the train crash, there's a whole bunch of unexplained events that happen in the town that they're in. So that's really the most basic description I can give.
Wow,
so
you've got, well done.
Thank you. Yeah, try to be concise. So what was in the train was a monster. So it's a monster movie, as well as being the movie about these kids and their friendship and growing up, etc. Mm-hmm. Discovering oneself, which we'll get into those things. What captured me about it most is the story about the kids. 1979, right. The whole feel of it, and Halloween's right around the corner, and this movie captures the Halloween feel to me, how Halloween was for me when I was a kid.
Independence, you mean, of being able to run around town on your own and do your own stuff.
Exactly right. And in the dark, and having friends like that. I really feel like he nailed that. I almost feel as if this movie, if it wasn't a monster movie, if it was just a movie about these kids making a movie, I probably still would have loved it. The monster movie part is kind of secondary.
I probably would have actually liked it better.
Mm-hmm.
I don't love it. I don't hate it. It was good.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the thing where it does shine is showing those kids and how they all just accept each other for who they are.
Yeah.
You know, there's the one kid who by the end of the movie, you just laugh because he's obviously got pyromaniac tendencies. And every time he's like, wow, look at those. Of course, I have a zillion firecrackers and things in my bag because who wouldn't want to blow stuff up? And the father at one point, who's a sheriff, the main kid's father, says, I worry about your friend and the way he loves fire.
Mm-hmm.
And but they don't really, they'll just kind of cut it out. Now's not the time, you know. Or the other kid who says, I'm mad at you because I invited this girl to do this thing. I'm interested in her and she's not even looking at me.
Yeah.
And then he says later, he goes, well, it's not your fault because he's the fat kid of the group. And he goes, I just haven't leaned out yet. The doctor says I will. It's coming soon, you know. Yeah. And so, but they all just accept each other. They don't think about it. And they also have this, what I love is the passion that they feel for doing each their own part of this movie thing.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the one kid who's obviously, I feel like this is J.J. Abrams channeling himself as the guy who's getting the movie going. Oh, we can use that. Film it. We could put that in. Hey,
yeah,
we can
production value.
The story.
He's always saying production value.
Yeah, production values, production values. Mm-hmm. And then the other kid who's like, he loves to do the monster makeup or just the movie makeup, that kind of thing. And then, of course, the other thing, I'm sorry, I looked at this movie and I was like, I feel like J.J. Abrams might have done this movie just to be able to do a train wreck. Doesn't every director want to do a big train wreck?
Oh, man,
this is a pretty great train wreck.
The finest train wreck I've ever seen. It is
beautiful. It is the best one since The Fugitive, I have to say.
Yeah, yeah.
Was that a real train? Because The Fugitive was.
I was just wondering. I doubt it was a real train. I can't imagine that it was, but maybe.
I'm very disappointed.
I would have to find out, but surely it's not.
Well, not with the cars dropping amongst the kids.
Yeah,
but the rest
I mean, those
of
things
it.
were way up in the air.
Well, you know,
let's launch this train car.
But it was going fast,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, wow.
Well,
so
yes.
So in Fugitive, they wrecked a real train?
Oh, yeah. They said, we have one shot at this.
Holy cow.
I remember.
I had no idea.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Wow. And they said, okay, clean this up. We'll see ya.
Yeah. Yeah.
We got it. We're going to move on. You guys take care
mm-hmm.
of this. Wow.
Mm-hmm.
I had no idea. That's an amazing story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Pretty great.
Tommy
right?
Lee Jones was great in that movie. That's what I remember about The Fugitive.
That's sometime we're going to have to watch that.
Yeah. I wanted to be Tommy Lee Jones in that movie. That's
Did not we all?
Oh my gosh.
Everybody, that's the movie I learned to love him in.
Yeah, well, me too. Yep.
And that's then great. Men in Black just cemented it.
Put up your hands and all your flippers. Oh, too good. Too good.
Where he was supposed to be the funny character, but he never really could deliver the lines right because he never really always saw the joke. So they went, okay, here we go. We're not going to just deliver it all straight.
I did not know that either. That's too funny.
I feel like I read that somewhere. Mm-hmm. Anyway, way off topic.
Anyway, yeah. So Super 8. Yeah.
Yeah,
the passion that they had.
Oh, go ahead.
No, you were talking about the passion that they all had. On the Pyromaniac Kid, that made me laugh because one of the things that I think about in the 70s is these military movies like Force 10 from Navarone and the Dirty Dozen, and they've always got a munitions expert that's a little bit off, you know.
And
I feel like that was like a homage to that. Like, we need to have our munitions expert.
That's so perfect.
Yeah. So I thought that was, you know, a lot of those movies came from the 70s.
Yeah. Well, and I know we have a difference in age, but I was watching it going, oh, yeah, on TV there's 3 Mile Island. They're just reporting it, you know, and I'm like, oh, right. I suddenly was back when that was on the TV a lot and everything.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't care about it. I was older than those kids. But it's the kind of thing where it's just like, yeah, it's part of the background.
Yeah.
You're not paying attention. And in fact, I was telling my husband, I was like, you know what I love about this movie? They got it all right. They did this. I said, not once did my pet peeve come up, which is somebody slipping the word awesome in there. And
he goes, that's cool.
Sorry, they did it. He goes, there's one point, and I can't remember. And he goes, I noticed it. They said, one kid said, awesome. And I'm like, that wasn't used then.
Oh, I'm sure that bothered the director. I recall, I didn't in preparation for this podcast, but I recall watching some extras one time. And one of the things that the kids said is that they needed to learn to be 70s kids. Mm-hmm. And they were telling him stuff like, you can't use this word, you can't use this word. In fact, Ellie Fanning was complaining about it, or, you know, complaining, quote unquote. She was just, you know, joking around, but
You're
saying, you're not allowed to say that, you're not allowed to say that, you're not allowed to say that.
Yeah.
So they were paying attention to it. If one slipped in there, that's a bummer.
No, and it felt, a lot of it felt right, because I was looking at things like, you know, you don't realize how much our regular life has changed until you watch a movie like this and you look at the gas station and the Quickie Mart type of a place, you know. And the kids had the passion. Sorry, we're way off topic.
No, that's fine. But again, you know, that's what captured me so much about this movie and why I keep watching it. I mean, I've just probably seen it 4 times. But he just absolutely nailed a part of my life. That when I watch this movie, I just feel so nostalgic and happy. It makes me feel really good watching it. All those kids, you know, I had friends, similar types of friends. I wasn't making movies. I liked to write and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I would share some of that stuff with these friends. So there was that kind of stuff going on. And then to go out running around in the dark, like we did at Halloween and things, not causing too much trouble, but a little bit. And then the girl even, you know, I think that the girl coming into the group, was really smart. You know, because that's when, you know, all these character things can come through. But even the girl, you know, I can remember, you know, us liking the same girl sometimes and yeah, she was fantastic. Yeah. I mean,
I really liked
both her and so that was Ellie Fanning and the kid who played Joe Lamb. Let me see if I can grab his name. Joel Courtney.
Yeah.
I thought they were both absolutely top notch. You know, there were a couple scenes that they had together, like when he was putting zombie makeup on her.
Yes.
And just with an expression, you know, he was able to convey some things, you know, because she was talking a little bit about his mom and, you know, Sarah's pain there. And yet he was just absolutely mesmerized by this girl.
Right.
I mean, just a lot of pumping emotions going through that kid. And he really, he gave that to me. I thought it was pretty good.
No, they did a great job at that, at being subtle in how they conveyed a lot of those kind of feelings. And of course, you recognize them.
Right. Yeah.
You know, and maybe that's, well, this movie made so much money and everybody loved it. And it's not that I didn't like it, like I say, but I didn't love it. But a lot of the feelings that you're tapping into are just, I'm going, oh, okay, I see it. I see it. I didn't relate to it that way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I enjoyed watching the passion of the kids. I enjoyed watching the mystery of, you know, what has scared all the dogs away outside of this radius? What is this monstrous thing that everybody's going, ah, and then, you know, they're gone. And even the part with the government coming in. And of course, that gives you a really great villain to hate because you're not allowed to hate the real people in the movie, which on a second viewing, especially, I found much more subtle or nuanced than you would expect in this movie. And I guess we could talk about that in a little while, but you're given the villain, which is the government, uncaring government people. And I did find the fact that they were eventually, you know, taking over the town and some of the tactics to be a bit, that's where I was like, oh, Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Not that it was supposed to be realistic, but I was like, okay. Conspiracy nuts everywhere. Here you go. It's your movie.
Yes. Yeah. Sure. Yeah. And, you know, I can't deny any of that stuff. And, yeah. And it really is two movies, isn't it? It's an old fashioned monster flick.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of the movies in the '50s, you know, the government was the problem and they were always, you know, and we mentioned E.T. and E.T., you know, all the government wants is to take this innocent alien and do experiments, you know. Which is what they did with this alien. It was the same type of story. But it was backstory in this case. Now they're chasing it as it escaped.
And actually, what's kind of interesting is when I was on my way back from Florida from the Horror Film Fest, all I have are earbuds, but I also have motion sickness. So I just have to shut my eyes and be thankful for an iPod and listen to stuff. So I was trying to see what would sound the best over the airline. And as I think I mentioned to you in an email, what sounded the best actually were I had some old episodes of our podcast on my iPod.
Oh, cool.
And so I was listening to the one on Waystation, and that's a comment we were talking about there is the government, the FBI, finds an alien grave and what's the first thing they do? They disinter everything and take it back to experiment on it.
Yep, let's cut it to pieces. We got to understand
and we were talking about not only is that a government thing, but that's kind of a human thing is, how does this work? How can I use it? What do I do with it?
Mm-hmm.
And of course, they were doing it to this alien.
Right, right. Yep, very common theme.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. So, yeah, I'm not sure if Spielberg was originally, you know, what was in his mind when he was doing E.T., you know, why he wrote it the way he wrote it. And the government in that movie was pretty scary. They were almost faceless in that movie. You know, you were seeing them almost from a kid's point of view where, you know, they had masks on, you know, the completely covered in the hazmat equipment.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of shot from down up to look like they were huge, which is the way E.T. and the kids would have seen them.
But also, didn't they say they'd had this? I'm sorry, I guess we're well into spoiler territory.
Oh, yeah, sure enough.
At this point.
Yeah.
Didn't they say they'd had that alien for 20 years or something like that?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm thinking, wouldn't they have replaced the government team by then if they hadn't found out any more than they had? Because these guys are singularly inefficient.
Sure. And they did replace the guy that caused the train wreck in the first place. He was a middle school teacher, so he'd moved on. They moved him right out of there.
How does that happen?
Mm-hmm.
Well, okay, I'll just go teach junior high.
Telling all the kids
with
about the alien.
Secret documents that I kept and my recordings.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But what I did like about this movie is that they had a couple of big themes, I thought. And one is that really excels from the kid's point of view was when Joe Lamb says about his mother who died in an accident, and he doesn't relate to his father or vice versa, really. He says, she used to look at me, really look, and I knew I existed. And how often are kids or other people ignored? Treat them on a superficial level, or that's, you know, I'm very busy, which the father still tends to do.
Yeah, that was one of the things that Abrams was talking about as well. Apparently, he had a really nice childhood. He said his parents are still married and everything, and he said, I know that's not typical. But when he was writing this, I found a thing where he was saying, he was thinking about the idea of loss and being without a parent. And he said, so the idea was that you have one parent that's really close to the kid and then one who's kind of distant. So he said his father, and I'm reading a quote, in a sort of typical 1970s way was a little bit less involved than I think dads are now. So his idea was, what if the parent that was close to the kid was gone? And then how do you reconcile that? And how does the father reconcile that? And that was part of the character of the father and Joe Lamb's experience. I remember a scene where the dad was like, you know, I'd like to send you to baseball camp. And he's like, no, I want to make this movie. And, that was a poignant scene. I enjoyed that scene a lot.
Yeah.
It was as if, you know, the parent was saying, you know, I need a break because this is huge responsibility and I don't know what to do. And from the kid's point of view, it's like, well, you know, this is like the final nail. You're tossing me aside.
And, you don't know me.
Right. You don't know me at all. Not only does he not interested in baseball, but, you know, you're sending me away. It's like a complete loneliness at that point. And then the next scene is him sneaking out and being with all his friends to go film the train scene.
Right.
And how happy he was. You know?
Yeah. And that's kind of interesting, thinking of being without a parent. I've never ever considered what would have happened to our little family if my mom had died, you know, and my dad was a difficult guy in a lot of ways. Not like Ellie's dad. Ellie. No, what was her name? That's I'm thinking
Alice.
Of Elle Fanning.
Alice. Yeah.
Alice. Not like Alice's father necessarily,
but
he really didn't connect on a lot of levels. He did on a few levels, and we appreciated that. But it had to be things that he already understood. Like, I have never been so – I mean, I'm always really good at giving presentations and stuff, because when I was in seventh grade, we had to give a huge science presentation in biology, and it was worth 500 points. It was worth a big chunk of your grade. And I'm the only person who ever got all 500 points.
Wow.
Because my dad took me through that presentation so many times, and I used everything I learned then to give sales presentations later and in college I would give presentations. I mean, and we bonded over that actually. And when it was time for me to go to work, my mom is like, "And wear this." And I'm like, "I cannot wear a red pantsuit." She just didn't get it for business attire. So my dad was like, "I need help, you know, and I'm going off to my first job." And my dad went, "Okay." And he took me and we went to a store where he found a good lady sales clerk and then he approved everything. And so the stuff where he did get it, it was great. But there were so few of those things intersecting in my life. And I think of being left to just him, and it would have been so, oh man, it would have been just like this movie. Oh my gosh. The nightmare for both of us.
Right. And then Joe Lamb in this movie, he's in that situation. And then there's one moment, a forgiveness moment. I guess we should say that Alice's dad called in sick and Joe's mom went to work in his place and she died during that shift. So it really wasn't, you know, directly Alice's dad's fault, but there was a lot of guilt and blame for it.
Because
he was drunk, right?
Yeah.
He had a hangover, and that's why he was sick.
Yeah, because if he'd have legitimately had the flu, mm-hmm. he wouldn't have felt that guilt.
Yeah, I probably would have.
Well, yeah. You would have felt it, but not to a debilitating point.
Not to a debilitating point, probably.
And not
so.
To the point where the the father would have not held you to blame so much, because that sheriff knew a lot about that town, or deputy sheriff, whatever
yeah.
he was.
Yeah, sure.
Knew a lot about everybody knew the reason he wasn't there, and it was that personal weakness that led to him not being there.
Yeah, yeah. And then there was a moment, actually, before the forgiveness moment, there was a moment with the dad where he's yelling at his son, because the dad is under a hell of a lot of pressure. He's now the sheriff, because his sheriff has disappeared, who has been eaten by a monster. Nobody knows that, though. But he tells his son, it used to be someone else, but now it's just me. Mm-hmm. And it was a parallel to their own life, too. And they, you know, he understood what he said right after he said it, but he was talking about the town.
Mm-hmm.
But he meant the whole family thing. It's like, you know, I'm having a hell of a time here.
Yeah.
So I thought that was a moment that was well done. And then later on, when the two dads are in the car together, and then they finally clear that air, that was a good moment too. Even though it was rushed.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it was very rushed at that point in the movie. You were pretty much rolling downhill and towards the end, because
yeah.
they were like, okay, we've got all these things now that we need to do. And there was some sacrifices in story, I felt, in order
right.
to get to the end. And one of them was how quickly that forgiveness happened. It's just like, you know, these guys are alone for 2 minutes and everything's great. And though I like the movie, the moment, I would have appreciated a slower pace, I guess. Which is another thing that I like about the movie that I haven't mentioned is, you know, the movie was a slow-paced movie up to a certain point. It was almost mm-hmm. like a throwback to a 70s movie. You know, a lot of them would dwell and take longer to tell a story. And, mm-hmm. and that's what this movie was doing for a while.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just having a scene where they're screwing around outside waiting for Alice to drive up in that yellow
yeah.
car. I don't know. I feel like there's not enough of that anymore, but
yeah,
I like those moments.
I feel like they could have handled some of the stuff at the end somehow differently, so that they could have lent a little bit more of that depth to the adult characters that you're talking about,
mm-hmm.
because they do hit those points, and I liked that they hit those points. I liked that they allowed the parents to also have their own issues that you were allowed to see a little bit of, because the kids didn't really understand them as well, but they understood the basics. You know,
yeah.
Elle kind of despised her father, even though she loved him. Or Alice.
Yeah.
And, but you could kind of see the father's love for his daughter, but also his self-loathing at the same time, just even in the scene where he's telling her to get out.
Mm-hmm.
And then he's running down the street. I didn't mean it, you know.
Yeah.
Leave me like your mother did. And
right.
So that, to me, combined with the kids, and they all, like I said before, they all had their issues. You know, because you felt like Alice is like, don't come to my house. She mm-hmm. had her school persona, and then she was ashamed of her home or her father.
Yeah.
You know, it was all run down and everything. And because they allowed everybody to have a more full character. They weren't just the kid who loves to make movies, the kid who does the makeup, the kid who, they all had a little bit more layering, except I guess for the tall, skinny kid or something. But anyway,
the tall, skinny kid, you know, he just made me laugh, but yeah, he wasn't,
yeah.
he didn't have a hell of a lot going on.
Yeah. He wasn't yeah. even a pyromaniac or whatever
yeah.
it was. So, but the thing was, is what that did is with the parents, it kind of gave depth to the line that was the heart of the movie, which even the alien is experiencing.
Mm-hmm.
And the kid tells him, bad things happen, but you can still live. And what does the alien have to do? At that point, he suddenly stops in his rage and fury and hurt and goes, yes, I am the prize. Rebuild my ship. Get out of here. I'm free. I can leave.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not just stuck here. But until he hears that from the kid or feels it telepathically or whatever, and sees what the kid's gone through, through their telepathic thing. And he's touched Alice also. And I felt like that was just, I know this is more than J.J. Abrams probably meant to put into it, but from my perspective as a person and as a Catholic, we get caught up in those patterns of rage and anger and hurt. And until we're willing to just let it go and push on to something better, we're going to be underground, surrounded by all the things that frustrate us, and we'll never get away from it.
That's right.
Hurting ourselves and hurting others.
I recently reread the first book that we ever did called Reapers or Angels. And in that, the main character says, you know, not to fight against the world. I can't remember exactly how she put it.
Yeah.
But, you know, she lived in a horrible world, but it's exactly the same point. You know, you can spend your whole life fighting against the world. You can accept some things, right?
Yeah. Well, on a very, very, very shallow level, I experienced that when I was flying back because of, I can't tell you, we got to the Orlando airport, which I hate anyway. and one thing after another went wrong. And so we wound up when we didn't, if these three errors from these three people hadn't happened, we could have zipped through security, been in plenty of time, all this stuff. And instead what we find is there's no seats left on the plane, even though we have reservations. We're stuck in the security line of, oh my gosh, I can't even tell you how many people. That was so poorly set up. I couldn't even believe it. And we're like, we have 15 minutes. Oh my gosh. You know, and I'm having a heart attack. And so is Hannah. We're just both trying to tamp down on it. And I'm going, at one point I finally go, you know what? I'm upset because I think I should have controlled all the stuff that I chose differently. I'm like, it's done. Mm-hmm. I have no control over anything except I got us to the airport. And then it was my happy Catholic moment. I went, okay, I am not in control of any of this. And God is in control of everything. And I'm like, we'll make the plane or we won't make the plane. That's not up to me. I'm just here floating down the stream at this point. This is what I can do. And I, you know, it was like that monster. I'll just move forward. I'm not going to fight these people and be mad at all these other people. And the lady who just tripped me with her suitcase because she was inconsiderate. Yeah. I'll just move on. And that's so small, but that's, it was so freeing.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a good example.
And what happened? Yeah. And not that God did this. It's just how it worked out because it's internal at that point. But the plane was 30 minutes late. No air conditioning, thank you, on the way out. But, you know, we were able to grab something to eat. We got the last two boarding passes, all these things. It would have been the same if I was furious, but how different was my ability to go through it?
Yeah, yeah, and that's it. Yep, you can be furious or you can accept what you can't control. That's great.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's works bad, small and big. You just have, it takes you longer to work through the big stuff so you can not fight the world.
Yeah. I'm always reminded whenever you talk reservations, it's, did you ever see the Seinfeld episode where they each they had the rental car?
Yes.
You can take the reservation, but you don't know how to hold the reservation, which is really the most important part.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like, why do you guys do that?
I understand reservations. No, I don't think you do. The thing I kept flashing on both ways, because all airlines are like this these days, but we took Southwest because it was that Love Field is 30 minutes closer than DFW. And we wound up being in the last boarding group each time. And it's this, you know, you just get on and find a seat. And so we're like, okay, we're going to be in the middle seats. And the way out, there were two guys on each side of me. And they did not have any courtesy when it came to the armrest.
Oh, yeah.
And so I just kind of had to fold my arms and try to kind of relax. And I was like, I feel like Elaine in that other Seinfeld episode where it's like being an immigrant steerage.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, Hannah behind her. She said, oh, I felt the same way behind me with some man who kept saying, but do you know Jesus? Do you have a relationship with him? And I'd listen to the poor guy behind me and I'd go, I don't want to hear this.
Oh,
I don't want to hear this.
That's too funny.
I said it could have been worse. It could have been next to you.
Yeah. Oh, I have to laugh at, you know, the visions everyone had about air travel back when it first started. You know, it's like, it's going to be like being in a lounge. It's going to be like a bar, and there's going to be all this stuff. And every experience I've had is sardine-like.
Yeah, it's a Greyhound bus is more comfortable,
yeah,
actually.
Yeah, it's very unpleasant. Flying is just so unpleasant. I don't know why it has to be that way.
Well, yeah. And then once they quit giving you food and everything else, it just makes it even worse.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, but that's kind of beside the point, too. I didn't mean to derail
us. Oh, another.
Derail.
And Scott just gets it. Ladies and gentlemen, 20 seconds later. That's too good.
If only I'd have said it on purpose, that would have really been great. But no.
That's great. Oh, shoot.
Gracious. So,
yep.
I also kind of really, the second part of the movie, it's right. Maybe it was that rushed thing because they suddenly went away more from the kids and you saw so much more of like the government holding facility that they were shoveling everyone into and them setting the fields on fire. So everybody has to go into this government facility. And I thought, I feel like I'm in Welcome to Night Vale, that podcast. And thinking this just doesn't seem like something that would have ever happened in 1973. It went too far, is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And by the time they're running across the town, and because of the aliens, I guess it was like a psychokinetic power or something. I never understood why, but all the weapons are firing on their own. And so there's rockets everywhere, and tanks are going berserk and everything. And the kids are running through it, and it looks like Serbia or something at that time period. And,
yeah, and there was a lot of laughs during that as well. I mean, it was over the top, and they sure made it feel that way.
This is the part of the movie I'm like, I have a real disconnect with. I just, at that point, emotionally, I just sat back and observed because there were some funny things and all that kind of stuff, but I didn't care anymore, you know?
Well, I still cared about Joe and Alice. And Joe going after Alice, I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah, that was good.
Telling her dad that he believed him.
Mm-hmm.
That was a cool moment, I thought.
Yeah.
But you're right. Overall, it started to kind of go off the rails, a little bit for me when they...
Okay, 10 seconds later, I did it. Fine.
When they find the... all that information that they need is at the middle school in a locker or a... thing, you know, like you mentioned that earlier, like the guy, you know, got away and he's a middle school teacher now and he's got all that stuff in a closet that, or a storage unit or whatever you call it, outside the school. You know, they were even talking about that on the way there. It's just really clunky. It was just, you know, it was put in there for that specific reason. And, I don't know. When I see it, it's just like, you know, it's a little bit of a wince moment where you're like, oh, okay, I'll ignore this piece and then just move on. So then now that they have all the information, but it's like, you know, the military was so dumb that they didn't think to look in the, you know, surely they searched the hell out of the school.
You'd think.
And the guy's house and everything, but they didn't think to look where everybody knew he had stuff because the kids did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was as if they had the basic story of, well, here's what the alien does, and the kids have to rescue each other, and they have to talk to the alien, but they didn't know exactly how to pad it out for the rest of it. I mean, because also then part of that disconnect is they start showing us more of the father, and you see a little bit of him beforehand anyway when he's having to deal with the sheriff things and it's moving the story along. But when he's suddenly dressing up in the army uniform and doing these things, and it's diverting your attention from the heart of the story. And I just think if they'd have sat back and taken one more look at it and kind of simplified it somehow, or so, I don't know. I don't know how I would have fixed
it. The only thing that I could have thought that would have fixed it would have made it much longer. And that may have been a consideration. It's you always have that storytelling problem where, okay, I need my characters to have a bunch of information and I need it to be really fast. Otherwise this is going to get boring. So, I mean, I think that's what he did, but, to have them discover that stuff in different ways just would have taken longer. Would have been a lot of cool stuff. You know, you could have, it's just a slower paced movie, longer.
No, I don't know, because they could have run across somebody who's now the leading scientist who's like, I now realize I was wrong. Quick, kids, let me just tell you this. Go, I'll cover for you.
Yeah, possibly.
I mean, just something. Cool. But anyway, it's whatever. That last part of the movie, I did like the stuff with the kids and, can you make a loud noise that will get his attention over here? Can I? Oh, the only question is which firecracker to use?
And you knew he was like, Chekhov's gun. You knew he was going to be used. He has a bag full of firecrackers that was established during the first 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And he's going to light that thing off at some time.
Yeah. Exactly.
But I liked his first reaction. I don't think that's going to work. because he thought he wanted him to blow up the alien. He's like, I don't think that's going to work.
Yeah.
Funny stuff. Well. Yeah. I love that character, like I said, in the old movies, too. He was always off. The explosives guy was always off.
And they did a good job, especially in the beginning, maybe, of making it so family oriented. So the kids are just darting in and out, like, the movie making kids family, which was so normal. It was the fighting siblings and all this, and the mother and father and all this kind of thing, who are perfunctorily kind to the Joe Lamb.
Yeah.
Have a mother. You can come sit down and have dinner anytime.
Yeah, that was nice.
Just come to me for anything you need. But it wasn't that cloying overprotectiveness. And it's just that you lost that feeling, and maybe there wasn't a way to keep it. But anyway.
Yeah, and I liked, that captured chaos of the family. That family wasn't unlike mine. There was four of us. Mm-hmm. And, get people coming in and out all the time and things. And, it can get chaotic. But there are movies that don't do that well. Like Columbus, Goonies. Isn't that Chris Columbus who did Goonies?
I haven't seen it.
Yeah, Goonies is a movie that, this movie could be compared to, because it was a group of kids and there was an adventure and everything. But Chris Columbus has this chaotic method. I don't know. In this movie, there was the chaos of that family and how people coming in and out and everything, but it was neat. It was very well done. But Chris Columbus, it's like watching Goonies to me is just, it's difficult for me to watch Goonies. People love Goonies, but it's just chaotic that I'm completely annoyed by it. I would need to turn the sound off.
Interesting. Well, because again, I was thinking about, I haven't seen E.T. in so long, but I know that in Poltergeist, I was just thinking back, there's a scene where and it's just three kids, the teenage daughter and the two little kids, and they're having breakfast. But the way the kids are teasing each other and mimicking each other, it's so natural seeming. And there were three of us. And that's the way it just kind of breaks down. And the parent imposes order for a second or I'm the one person that needs to hear it the most, and then they just go off and ignore it because, that's just how kids are.
Right.
And that felt very real in this movie, too. So,
So I'm looking at Goonies here. Chris Columbus wrote it, but Richard Donner directed it. And it's a well-loved movie.
Oh, Superman. He did Superman, didn't he? With the one Christopher Reeve Superman. Yeah.
Lethal Weapon. I know he did Lethal Weapon.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that was good too.
Yep. Yep.
But maybe kids weren't his thing.
No, I mean the movie is beloved. I mean, people still talk about Goonies.
I know it's iconic. Everybody's
so it's just me. It's not everybody.
Yeah.
I watch it and I get pretty tense.
I trust your eyes, Scott.
Yeah. Close Encounters of the Third Kind did that to me too. I like the movie, but It's not a movie I like to rewatch because
no, I don't like it.
It does have this chaotic, uneasy feeling throughout that it's just not pleasant.
I did not like that movie, but let's be fair, I really don't like Richard Dreyfuss. So there's the heart of the movie there. Not his fault.
Not a Richard Dreyfuss fan.
Ugh. Yeah. Except for in Goodbye Girl, that iconic scene of, and I don't like the pantyhose in the shower, which you've maybe not seen, but it's one that John Belushi used to mimic on Saturday Night Live.
Oh, yeah.
Talk about showing my age, right?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
What about Jaws? Do you like Jaws?
You know, I saw Jaws so long after it originally came out that it didn't grab me the way it did people seeing it. And to me, I didn't care about it.
I liked it. Yeah.
And it wasn't because of Richard Dreyfuss. He was fine in that role. It was good for him. And I love, who was it? Who was the, you know, the sheriff?
Scheider, Roy Scheider. Yeah.
Love Roy Scheider. All That Jazz. One of my favorite movies.
That one I've never seen. All That Jazz.
Well, it will either strike you as dated or amazing. It made me a Bob Fosse fan. I was like, you can do this movie about your own freaking life? Wow. Yeah, it was amazing.
Very cool. Well, all right. Well, have we said all there is to be say about Super 8?
And meandered everywhere. So I believe it was like the last part of the movie. Hopefully the chaos was something.
Now all we need is the rushed ending.
Okay, so I guess we're done now.
But no, I really, really, really love this movie. Yeah, it's not flawless, but man, yeah, I just love watching it.
Well, and I can see why, because it really conveys a certain time period and a certain feeling, and that intensity of both of childhood and of somebody who's just loves what they do. And that's why I said I could really feel like that movie making kid was like J.J. Abrams or anybody who's a creative person where they just see everything around them and they go, I can use that in this book, movie, whatever. I can use that in this art because they're just so attuned to it. So I did love that quality about the movie.
Cool.
And I really loved those two, what I took away as the two main messages of not just the parent. Do we look at people and really know they exist? You know, do we give people the attention that they deserve? And then also, bad things happen, but you can still live. We all have bad stuff. It's just different levels of bad. And the way that Catholics would look at it is, and Christians of any sort, hopefully, is that what the bad things that happen, of course, your faith helps you still live. It doesn't negate it. It doesn't make it go away, but it makes it so you can move on and do something better and put it in proper perspective.
Yeah, well put. And thank you very much for that.
Yeah, thank you.
That's great. All right, so next week we shift gears. I'm sorry, not next week, next time. The Catholic Church Through the Ages, a History.
Yeah.
By John Vidmar. There's almost no alien monsters in that book at all.
Very few.
Very few.
And not much movie making either.
You bet. And then after that is a movie that you've selected. Hero.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
No alien monsters in that, but plenty of martial arts in Hero.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
And I've got my copy of the next book. It's right here. There it is. The In This House of Breed by Rumor Godden.
I'm really looking forward to rereading it.
Yeah. Excellent.
It's, talk about shifting gears.
Yeah.
Very different.
That's cool. That's cool. And then after that, I'm picking a movie to end the year with. Mm-hmm. And I've decided to go with Home Alone 6, which is it.
Oh, I think I'm going to be sick that week. Can you find someone else to do that?
I actually have not picked one yet, but I need to get that done.
Considering how much I loved the first Home Alone. Such a fan. John Hughes and me, we're just like that.
That's too funny.
Please do not pick Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. Begging you. Begging you.
Okay, I will not. Oh, okay, you that makes could. Me laugh.
I would suffer. My husband would be thrilled, but I would suffer through it for your sake.
Now, talk about an airplane rant. He needs to. He needed to have the lecture.
Yeah.
Oh, that's too funny. Oh. But no, it won't be Home Alone anything. But,
oh, thanks.
Yeah. But I do have to get that picked, so.
Nah, you have time.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. Well, thanks, everybody, for listening. And yes. Happy Halloween.
Ooh, happy yes. Halloween.
Get you some Bradbury before it's too late.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And what was your Bradbury this year?
I actually haven't got to it yet this year, but I've got the October Country. And ooh. I'm going to read a few of those stories.
That's one of my favorites.
Yes, I love that book.
Yes, I listened to The Halloween Tree recently. Mm-hmm.
Oh,
it
that's
was deliciously
nice.
Good.
Oh, man. Read by Bronson Pinchot. No,
yeah. That man is so good. I would listen to books I hate just to hear him read them.
Yeah, he's astounding. He's stunning. Stunningly good reader.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. All right. Well, thanks, everybody. We'll see you in a couple weeks.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.